Genesis 42 through about halfway through Genesis 45 is where we are this morning. So if you can just keep your finger in that, and if you don't have your Bibles with you, the specific scriptures will be up on the screen. Each of us this morning come with various things facing us in our life. Of the amount of people that are here, there are that many different kind of scenarios that are going on where things are difficult. Life is filled with many wonderful things, and yet there are many weights that we feel, many things that are wrestlings. Perhaps the weight you feel is at work. Perhaps it's in your marriage. Perhaps it's the weight of parenting or your schooling, whether a teacher or a student. Maybe it's in your finances. Could be in your health, both physical or mental health. Perhaps it's in various feelings and emotions that you have that seem so overpowering over your mind and your body. Each of us come to this gathering every single Sunday, whether you are a small child, a teenager, or the oldest one among us, we come each and every week with different wrestlings, different struggles, different joys to be sure, but many weights. As I look around, for those of you whom I know, I see we know some of the weights that you feel that are on you, and some of you who might be on live stream today, a few in particular, where we know that there are just difficult things that we're facing. How might one message speak into so many different contexts? How is it that the story we come to this morning give strength and comfort and endurance and encouragement and consolation and correction to such a variety of needs we have individually and corporately? Recall that the book of Genesis tells specific stories that Moses is writing to the people of Israel who were about to enter the promised land. They each had lives. They weren't just this vast group of people that were on the edge of the promised land ready to go in with faith. They did not have as much faith as they wished they had. And not only that, corporately they didn't have that much faith. There was a sense of they struggled with the same things that you and I struggle with. They too were parents. They too had marriages that were both joyful and difficult. Relationships that were breaking amid their families or amid their country. They experienced all sorts of difficulties, whether it's financial or emotional or whatever. They were just like you and I, all individuals facing various trials, yet corporately facing one major hurdle before them, and that was as they were entering the promised land. The one major hurdle, though, in all the trials that kind of is an overarching issue, that is the question of whether or not God is trustworthy. In all of your struggles, in all of your trials, in all of your frustrations, whether you are a teenager, whether you are an adult, whether you are a child, whether you are a senior, the question that we come to this text with is, do I trust God? Is God trustworthy for the situations that I'm in today? The stories aren't primarily written here that we might grow in having a more moral life. We're not just looking at these stories and saying, you need to be more like Joseph in this way or that way. You need to not be as much like Reuben or Judah or whoever. Instead of turning these stories into moral lessons, we need to focus on the context of the book and ask ourselves, what is it that the Israelites needed to know as a group and as individuals to be prepared for their journey? And in these stories, the one we come to notwithstanding this morning, we should not get lost in the specific details, but rather ask the same question of what is there that the Israelites needed to know about God. They find themselves to face the struggles that they're dealing with, both individually and corporately. And by doing this, we can learn then by thinking about what Israel needs to hear, we can think about what it is we need to hear this morning. Because the problem of humanity remains the same thousands of years later. Our issues are not unique. Your struggle this morning, as potentially devastating as your struggle is not new in this world. It's important to remember that the story of Joseph is not just a story on its own. It is the story of Jacob. It's within the story of Jacob, the overarching story of Jacob. He is known as Israel. Jacob's life was full of difficulties. He had a challenging relationship with his brother Esau. He deceived his father Isaac. He dealt with issues in his relationships with his two wives and their respective servants. And despite all these difficulties, God remained faithful, as we've seen over and over again. He's remained faithful to his covenant promises, and he's changed Jacob's name to Israel. Although Israel's family was not yet a nation, they were just a group of people. And they faced, though, corporately, a shared group of problems, including, as you might remember from weeks past, the defiling of Dinah and the story of Judah and Tamar. And the brothers selling Joseph into slavery and lying to their father about it. This was a relatively or greatly dysfunctional family where we see God being faithful amidst it all. God was faithful to his covenant promises. While the story may seem to focus on Joseph during these difficult years, it's actually a story about God fulfilling his promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, or Israel. In recent weeks, we've learned that we can have faith in God to bring about his plan of salvation. We've learned that God is always present with us. We've learned that we can rely on God's compassionate providence as we anticipate our ultimate redemption. We sing songs about it. We're pressing this reality over and over again. It's not like we're doing it as pastors. It's the text is doing it for us. These are the stories that we come to. This morning, we will be delving into this lengthy story with a lot of detail to cover, but we're going to concentrate on that which the story highlights regarding how God himself continues to fulfill his covenant promises and bring reconciliation and peace to his people. And as we think about that, may we feel that same sense of peace and wonder and redemption and reconciliation and peace that Israel felt in those days. May we feel it this morning in our own sorrows, in our own struggles, our own wrestlings. Now, to make it more manageable, what we're going to do is break it up into three chunks. Pretty much on chapters, we're going to break up into those. We'll analyze the events very briefly, super briefly, and then bring two observations to each section, and then we'll come to some application at the end. So let's begin with chapter 42, where we're reminded in this first chunk, we're reminded of this. If you take a note, these are the mains to take home. Amid the severest circumstances, we can trust the sovereign God who knows all things. It's not a story about taking away the circumstances. This is a story about the fact that amid the severest circumstances, we can trust the sovereign God who knows all things. Consider the story with me. The chapter begins this way in chapter 42, verse 1. When Jacob learned that there was grain for sale in Egypt, he said to his sons, Why do you look at each other? And he said, behold, I've heard that there is grain for sale in Egypt. Go down and buy grain for us there that we may live and not die. We got Canaan, the country. Jacob and his family are hit by a famine. They're leading Joseph's brothers to go to Egypt, all the way down to Egypt where they meet him. Jacob is still affected by Joseph's disappearance and is protective of Benjamin, who is the other daughter of his loved wife. Or son of his loved wife. The text quickly moves to the moment when Joseph meets his brothers, leaving us wondering what's going to happen next. And so they go down to Egypt, and after recognizing his brothers, Joseph treats them harshly rather than welcoming them. He treats them harshly. He recognizes them, he treats them harshly, and accuses them of being spies. He knows they're not spies, of course, but he is treating them harshly for a reason. His true motive is to test their character and see if they have changed at all from the time that they sent him into exile in Egypt. In this story, Joseph puts his brothers in prison as a test. He keeps Simeon, one of the brothers, in prison and requests that they bring Benjamin back with them. Not just requests, but demands if they want to see Simeon released. He needs to test if his full-blooded brother is being treated the same way as he had been years before, and if his brothers have any sense of mercy whatsoever. In other words, have they changed? Is there something different about them in these days? In verses 21 through 23, we learn that Joseph's brothers seemed to be just as enslaved and imprisoned as Joseph had been on account of the guilt that they felt before God. They experienced this guilt in the 13 years since they sold him into slavery. Verses 21 through 23 says this: "Then they," that is the brothers, "said to one another, 'In truth, we are guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the distress of his soul when he begged us, and we did not listen.'" You remember back just a number of chapters ago, they did not feel pity at all. They were excited to see him go. They were so jealous of him and so angry at him and so hateful towards him that they sold him into slavery. Well, now they're saying, "We saw the distress of his soul when he begged us, and we did not listen. And that's why this distress has come upon us." And Reuben answered them, "Did I not tell you not to sin against the boy? But you didn't listen. I told you so. So now there comes a reckoning for his blood." They did not know, of course, in that moment that Joseph understood them, for there was an interpreter between them. So Joseph is hearing all this, and he's seeing, something different in these boys. And he clearly understands that they're responsible for their actions against Joseph and accept that they deserve punishment. They admit to being hard-hearted and guilty of causing harm. And this was a good start. But despite Joseph being moved by their confessions, he's committed to continuing the test to determine the depth of their remorse. How sorry are they? And after returning home, the brothers realize that they still have the money that they had brought down to Egypt to pay for the grain with, and it was put back in their bags, and they open it up and they realize that they're in trouble. Verse 28 says, "At this their hearts failed them, and they turned trembling to one another, saying, 'What is this that God has done to us?'" His brothers continue to believe that their trouble that they're experiencing is actually punishment from God. God's after them. God is going to destroy them. God is going to punish them. Meanwhile, Jacob, who is unaware of his son's sins, he's just saddened and laments that, "Man, everything is against me. They want to take my other son." At the end of the chapter, Jacob decides to keep Benjamin with him, despite Reuben's excessive assurance that it's all up to him. He'll handle it. And this is what Israel says. He says, "My son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead." And Jacob has no idea, right, of Joseph, as his brothers have no idea either. His brother is dead, and he is the only one left. Benjamin is the only one left. "If harm should happen to him on the journey that you're to make, you would bring down my gray hairs with sorrow to Sheol." Now, two quick observations. First observation is this: God sovereignly uses difficult experiences being faced by his people to bring about healing, restoration, and reconciliation. God sovereignly uses difficult experiences being faced by his people to bring about healing, restoration, and reconciliation. He was fulfilling his promises to Jacob and his sons during a devastating famine. We read that as though it's no big deal. It's a famine, devastating famine, bringing them to the end of themselves, forcing them to go down to Egypt, where they are going to face what amounts to significant trouble. The difficult treatment they received by Joseph, who himself had gone through similar hardship, God brought the family closer to each other and to him. He was moving them towards restoration. He was moving them towards reconciliation, though the boys could not see it whatsoever. Despite the challenges they faced, God showed mercy to the family amid a famine, amid the difficulties, who would one day be a blessing to all the nations of the earth. He was blessing the nation, blessing Israel, in the middle of famine, in the middle of hardship, to keep his covenant promises to them. Certainly hard to see, but true nonetheless. Second observation is that God knows the whole of our stories. God knows the whole of our stories. Years prior, God had given Joseph a couple of dreams that highlighted the brothers and even his parents bowing down before him. Certainly it got Joseph in trouble because he spoke of it in front of his brothers and his parents, and they were upset with him. They couldn't see it. He didn't know what it was about either, but now it's starting to make sense. Back in that day, it caused significant jealousy and anger from all of his family. But here we are aware of the dreams that were given by an all-knowing God being fulfilled by the all-knowing God. And God knows the whole of our stories. At any moment in this story, the brothers were blind to the reasons for their difficulties. All they could think of was that God was punishing them. All they saw was their sin. There was no sense whatsoever that God was at work. In fact, God hadn't left them, but God was punishing them. They were just blind to the reasons for these difficulties. They thought they knew, but they didn't. In Joseph, we see a small sliver of the providential power and omniscience of God. The brothers and Jacob only saw affliction and trouble. But Joseph, what does Joseph know? And Joseph knows who he is. Joseph knows what he's doing. He's ultimately working for their good. The brothers and the dad had no idea. But Joseph knew. It was just the brothers and Jacob thought there were just a bunch of random things that were coming against them. But we know that all these events, no matter how dark and difficult they are, were actually in the hands of someone wise and good and able, and us thousands of years later are encouraged by that which they're going through, because we know the end of the story. God knows your story. He knows what you're going through. And he knows the end of the story. He's trustworthy. For them, in the middle of their mysterious and difficult providences, it was impossible to see God's good hand that was at work, and we are no different than them even today, thousands of years later. But what we can learn on this side of the story is that amid the severest circumstances, we can trust the sovereign God who knows all things. Secondly, amid the greatest unfaithfulness, we can trust the sovereign God who is faithful to his promises. In Genesis 43, Judah convinces Jacob to let him and his brothers take Benjamin to Egypt. And despite his reluctance, Jacob agrees. And why does he agree? Well, he agrees because he's hungry, because he's in charge of this family, this large family. They can't eat. And so he agrees out of desperation. The brothers carry goods down to Egypt with Benjamin accompanying them. The first visit, the brothers felt guilty and sorry for what they had done. On their second visit, they were surprised and confused by what happened next. Because when they showed up, they were invited to a meal in the vizier of Egypt's house. They had no idea he was Joseph, right? So it would be as though the vice president invited you to her house. Actually, it would be far more than that. This vizier had control of the entire country of Egypt underneath Pharaoh. And so they show up. They just think they're who they are. God's judging them, punishing them, is what they're thinking. And they come back down out of desperation. And now this guy wants to have them over for dinner. It's entirely unexpected. It tempted them to assume that the invitation might be a trick. This is so crazy. What's going on? They say in verse 18, chapter 43, verse 18, the men were afraid because they thought they were brought to Joseph's house. And they said, it's because of the money. The money that was in the bags. It's because of the money which was replaced in our sacks for the first time that we are brought in so that he may assault us and fall upon us to make us servants and seize our donkeys. He's tricking us. When they tried to explain to the steward of Joseph's house what had happened with the money in their sacks, they were met with something that they hadn't expected either. Remember that they believed that all of this was happening to them because God was punishing them. Now the steward of Joseph's house tells them something altogether different. This is an Egyptian speaking this. And he says this: "Peace to you, and do not be afraid. Your God and the God of your father has put treasure in your sacks for you. I received your money." When Joseph's brothers visit him, they bring gifts. Joseph blesses his youngest brother. Benjamin is entirely overwhelmed. He sees Benjamin, and Joseph is entirely overwhelmed by the sight of him, and he tests his brother's envy by giving Benjamin a larger portion at dinner. This is why he gives him five times as much. One, because he loves him. Two, because it's testing. Testing the jealousy of his brothers. Have they changed? The end of chapter 43, it ends by saying that all is well. It says, "And they drank and were merry with him." Things seem really, really good. So two quick observations of this chapter. Obviously, we are skipping through very quickly here. But an observation in this chapter is that Judah takes the front seat and becomes the effective leader of the family of Israel. In the previous chapter, it was Reuben. Reuben was leading, and nothing was happening. Nobody was following. Jacob, his father, was like not listening to him. There was no sense of any sort of leadership there, even though he was the oldest. But Judah then, in this chapter, he shows himself as a leader who is being listened to. And remember the context of Israel hearing this. Israel hearing this hundreds and hundreds of years later. Judah taking the front seat. The transition of leadership of Judah at this point would make sense to the people of Israel, where the Messiah himself was supposed to come from, where the king was supposed to come from. That's a reality in this text. We begin to see this different thing happening, Judah taking leadership in Israel. Second observation, we see God fulfilling his promises to bless the nations through the unfaithful family of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, significantly unfaithful, very much men of faith on the other hand, but unfaithful in their actions so much. And in Jacob's family, so much unfaithfulness, so much difficulty, and yet we see God continuing to not let them go, but to fulfill his promises, to bless the nations through them. There's a growing sense of peace in the family, a growing sense of reconciliation among the family, indicating that the process God is committed to is underway, though still enduring difficulty. They're still not sure what's going on, but there's some joy, there's some peace, there's some seeming reconciliation, though they don't understand everything that's going on. For them, in the middle of their mysterious and difficult providences, it was impossible to see God's good hand at work. And we're no different than them even today, thousands of years later. And what we can learn on this side of the story is that amid even our great unfaithfulness, we can trust the sovereign God who is faithful to all of his promises. Finally, amid the most devastating experiences, we can trust the sovereign God who brings peace. Amid the most devastating experiences, we can trust the sovereign God who brings peace. We come to chapter 44, and here Joseph gives one more test to determine whether the brothers are truly changed. So verses 1 through 5 in chapter 44. "He commanded the steward of his house, 'Fill the men's sacks with food, as much as they can carry, and put each man's money in the mouth of his sack, and put my cup, the silver cup, in the mouth of the sack of the youngest, with his money for the grain.' And he did as Joseph told him, and as soon as the morning was light, the men were sent away with the donkeys. They had gone only a short distance from the city. And Joseph said to his steward, 'Up, follow after the men, and when you overtake them, say to them, "Why have you repaid evil for good? Is it not from this that my Lord drinks, and by this that he practices divination? You have done evil in doing this.'" So we see that the brothers are accused of stealing this valuable cup from Joseph's house. They offer to face the death penalty if the cup is found among them. And the situation takes an unexpected turn when the cup is found in Benjamin's sack. The sack, the son whom Jacob said, I don't want him to go. I don't want him to be taken from me. It says in verse 13 of chapter 44 that they tore their clothes. It was such a grievous situation. Every man loaded his donkey and they returned to the city. And the grief of the brothers here gives an early indication that they are indeed changed men. Just years prior, they had sold Joseph into slavery, and they thought they went free. And they were happy to do so. Now their hearts are different. Still, they have to go back to Egypt. In verse 16, the story reaches its climax when Judah says, what shall we say to my Lord? What shall we speak, or how can we clear ourselves? God has found out our guilt, found out the guilt of your servants. Behold, we are my Lord's servants, both we and he also, in whose hand the cup has been found. Now recall that in Genesis 37, Judah's speech plays a crucial role in setting the narrative's course of Joseph being sent into slavery. He had originally suggested selling Joseph, which ultimately led to the events in the story. But now he steps forward and refuses to sell Benjamin. Judah's speech here provides critical information that is essential to the test that Joseph is giving them. It becomes clear to Joseph that Judah, along with his brothers, have undergone a remarkable transformation. Rather than being selfish and self-centered, like take the boy and we'll go, Judah's become a wonderful example of selflessness. He's willing to bear the heavy yoke of slavery, even at the cost of his own well-being, rather than shift the blame to someone else. And so, seeing this with his eyes right before him, Joseph finally breaks in chapter 45, verse 1. Then Joseph could not control himself before all those who stood by him. He cried, make everyone go out from me. So no one stayed with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept aloud so that the Egyptians heard it and the household of Pharaoh heard it. And Joseph said to his brothers, I am Joseph. Is my father still alive? As you might imagine, his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. Such a shocking surprise. So much more to go into, but what we see here is finally some peace. 20-some years of extreme difficulty have passed, but now shocking peace. What amounts to, in the verses to come, the chapters to come, restoration and reconciliation of a very broken family, people of God. Redemption, salvation through the faithlessness and sin and conflict of men to the hardship and pain and tears and mystery of life, God remained faithful and God brought peace to them. To Joseph, certainly years prior, this couldn't have been further from his wildest imagination. For the brothers, there were simply no words, literally no words. God had brought peace for his people out of circumstances that were literally impossible. So two quick observations. First observation is this. In this story, we see the brothers, especially Judah, display humility and brokenness. They display humility and brokenness. Judah's humility leads him to self-sacrifice, which comes about through God's providential actions that remove his self-sufficiency. He just submits. We just see him submitting to God, even though he's still not thinking right about God's and God's providences. We'll talk about that in the chapters to come, about who's behind all of this, that they would see that God is actually working for good. But right now, they don't see that. But what they do know is that their lives are absolutely dependent on God. Self-sufficiency is stripped. These providences are challenging, but help God's people recognize their sins and become humble servants. Their transformation results in the wonderful outcome of relational restoration, redemption, salvation, and joy. It's humility, humility, humility is taking place in dependence on God. Where there is no humility, there is no grace. Where there is humility, God pours out his grace. where there is pride, where there is no humility, it's not as though there's just a lack of grace. There is actually the resistance of God against you. But here we see humility, and humility results in these wonderful gifts of God, good gifts. Second observation, I want us to take note just for a moment of the deepest of wells of love found in Joseph for his brothers. Rather than 20 years of bitterness that you might imagine having been built up, Joseph is a man just like you and me. If your brothers did that to you, if you went through the slavery in Potiphar's house, if you were blamed for sleeping or trying to sleep with Potiphar's wife, if you then were, because you were blamed for that, you were sent into prison where you were likely beat in an ancient Egyptian prison, and you had to stay there for years. Then these two guys who had heard the interpretation of their dreams through Joseph, the one who remains afterwards, he forgets to even say anything about him to Pharaoh. He's just forgotten about. Would you not hold a little bit of bitterness in your heart? When treated poorly? Rather than 20 years of bitterness, 23 years, I think, that could have built up, there was instead real love, a real trust in God, a real forgiveness, a real reconciliation, a real relational intimacy and peace in God and his plan that grew through the years of difficult providences. Through all the difficulties, Joseph understood that God was with him, empowering him, strengthening him for the task ahead, keeping his eyes on him so that when his brothers show up, he doesn't just destroy them, doesn't just want to get back at them, but actually test them to see if they've changed because he loves them. For all of them throughout this entire story, in the middle of their mysterious and difficult providences, it was impossible to see God's hand that was at work. But at work he was nonetheless. We see it. He never left them, but was orchestrating everything for the praise of his glorious grace as he stayed true to his covenant promises. We are no different than them today, even though thousands of years later, and neither is our God. We're not different. God's not different. What can we learn on this side of the story is that amid the most devastating experiences that you're facing even today or will face, we can trust the sovereign God who will bring peace. Let me share two primary applications and then we'll close. It's important to remember that although our difficulties may be different than we find in this text, God lovingly and sovereignly intends for them to help us come to the end of ourselves and to turn to him humbly to rely on him for sustenance and healing and redemption and salvation. He is for the good of his people. It does not feel that way sometimes. But this story helps us understand that even amid the severest of circumstances, the most difficult experiences, painful relationships, difficulties, God is working sovereignly, mysteriously for the good of his people. At the beginning of the chapter, circumstances were desperate. At the end of the chapter, they seemed to only get worse. The assumption was that they were being punished for their past actions, but in reality, God was powerfully and sovereignly doing deep work through their adversity to providentially bring healing, redemption, and salvation. What severe experience are you facing this morning? What need do you have? What struggle is it you face, spiritual, emotional, psychological, physical, economic? Do you feel as though the Lord is against you? Where are you? Why are you making this happen? What have I done to cause this to happen? Sounding like the brothers. Do you feel that God is not mindful of you and that he's absent? I know the struggles can be so very deep and difficult, and I know, man, I know that there are many of you who are going through significant difficulty. So it's not trying to throw that difficulty away and say, stop crying. There's much to cry about. What you're going through is difficult. So very difficult. Unbelievably difficult, some of you. But one thing I know even more from God's word and from experience through the lives of many people over the last 3 decades, and no matter how deep the struggle, no matter how severe the circumstance, greater yet is the sovereign loving kindness of God that intends to heal you and redeem you and save you and restore you, save you, to protect you, to keep you. A song says it really well this way: God moves in a mysterious way his wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm. Deep in his dark and hidden minds, with never failing skill, he fashions all his bright designs and works his sovereign will. Oh, fearful saints, new courage take. The clouds that you now dread are big with mercy and will break in blessings on your head. Judge not the Lord by feeble sense, but trust him for his grace. Behind a frowning providence, he hides a smiling face. God's purposes will ripen fast, unfolding every hour. The bud may have a bitter taste, but sweet will be the flower. Blind unbelief is sure to err and scan his work in vain. God is his own interpreter, and he will make it plain. So God, we trust in you. We remind one another this morning of Psalm 62:8. Without having all the answers to all the scenarios that are going on and the pain that you're experiencing, we say out loud, trust in him at all times, O people. Pour out your hearts before him. God is a refuge for us. Second application. According to Scripture, God orchestrated 2 significant salvations through 2 faithful servants. The first salvation occurred when God sent imperfect Joseph to Egypt to save his family, that is, the Israelites, from a severe famine. And through God's providence in Joseph's life, the Israelites were saved. God's covenant purpose to redeem a people for himself to dwell with from among the nations forever continued without a threat. Plenty of threats, but no real threat. Nothing threatens God's sovereign plan. Many things might cause us to question God's sovereign plan and whether it's going to last, but God is not fearful. God is not swayed. God is going to do what he's going to do. God is a covenant God. He is faithful to his promises. His steadfast love is steadfast. It is unwavering whether we see it or not in any given moment. He is the faithful one. Like the reality in the text that God will stay true to his covenant promises because, not just because they're promises and he is going to keep his promises, but because he is faithful as God. He is the covenant God. He will never let his covenant go away. Second salvation was spiritual in nature and was accomplished through not an imperfect one, but the perfect Son of God, Jesus himself. Jesus came into the world to save all people from their sins and reconcile them with God if they would just trust in him. Like Joseph, Jesus suffered greatly. He was betrayed. He was arrested. Ultimately, though, he was crucified. But it's through his death and through his resurrection that Jesus provided a way for all people to be saved and reconciled with God, reconciled with each other and reconciled, most importantly, with God through God's providence, in the difficult providence in the life of Jesus and in all the difficult providences he experienced, especially in the days of his death. All those who would place their trust in him would be saved, and the covenant purposes of God to redeem a people for himself to dwell with from among the nations forever would continue once and for all. He will be true to his promises, not because Joseph was the sacrifice, but because the king himself was the sacrifice. Speaking of God and of his Christ, the writer of the Hebrews says this: it was fitting that he, for whom and by whom all things exist, in bringing many sons to glory, should make the founder of their salvation perfect through suffering. For he who sanctifies and those who are sanctified all have one source. That's why he is not ashamed to call them brothers. Joseph's brothers were blessed to have him as family. Now, you might imagine they are so hungry, so empty, so feeling guilty, and they come and they all of a sudden they realize, not all of a sudden, but years later, they recognize who he is. And they recognize, wow, he's the second in command. And they're given a land, and the best land, as we see in the end of chapter 45 and on. This blessing was only for their physical and material needs, though. Having Jesus as a brother is a much greater blessing. Jesus, the Son of God, came to earth, lived a perfect life, died in our place, rose again to bring many people to glory. He came to save us from our sin. He came to save us from the eternal punishment that we rightly deserved because of our sin against holy God. He came to redeem us, to buy us back, to bring us into his kingdom, to reconcile us to himself, that we might know temporal peace in the moment, right now, through whatever we're going through, and eternal peace before him, our holy God. The king intends good for his people, even though there are hours and days and weeks and months and years that are significantly difficult, unbelievably difficult. Yet God is faithful in it all. And that's no just spiritual, like, try this. This is foundational reality for the one who is found in Jesus Christ. Have you believed in him? Do you consider Jesus' Father as your Father? And that's why he came, to help us be reconciled with the Father and bring many sons, daughters, people to glory. Application point. Don't forget that. Amid all your sorrows, all your struggles, don't forget though our brother Christ, is the one who brings all things to reconciliation. He's the one who brings peace. He's the one who brings healing. He's the one who brings restoration. No matter what you're going through, you can rest in that. You can rest in your circumstances. We want to rest in our circumstances, but our circumstances are far from places we can rest. But God, the faithful one, the immovable one, the refuge, the, Kale mentioned earlier, the rock, the fortress. He is our deliverer. He is the one who gives us all we need. Remember that when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his Son, born of woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, so that we might receive adoption as sons. And because you are sons, God has sent the Spirit of his Son into our hearts, crying, Abba, Father. So you are no longer a slave, but a son. And if a son, then an heir through God. It must have been wonderful for the brothers to have Joseph as their brother, but how much more amazing to have King Jesus as ours. Through adoption, his father becomes our father. His inheritance becomes our inheritance. We share in the glory that he entered into, even partnering with him in some way with his sufferings. So by the grace of God alone, received through faith alone, we might live in hope and rest, and even joy and contentment. What is it we need to know today amid all the many different scenarios that we experience? Let me just state it this way in an application. Purpose in your heart today to believe that amid all the wonders and tumult of your life stands the unfaltering goodness, steadfast love, and eternal purposes of your faithful Father. This is what the Spirit's doing in us. The Spirit's not just making us a little bit more spiritual people. The Spirit is moving in us to open our eyes to see the glory of God amid our struggles, not just in the good times. He certainly has won the victory, and there are victories along the way, and there will one day finally be victory, absolute victory, where no more sin, no more struggle, no more sickness, no more death. All that stuff will go away, but for this season, for this time, God has won that victory so that we can experience victory in this life through the difficulties and through the joys. The question is, will you trust him? Will you trust him? And I pray each of us do, for this is the one needful thing that each one of us have, no matter what our specific struggles are. Our general need and our most overarching and undergirding need is that we would trust that the God who has promised is the God who is faithful.